Well, this next question may seem to be a joke. Is there a monkey in your family tree? But it actually is taught as dead serious fact as if it were the law of gravity in our colleges and universities today. The idea is that man is at the apex of the alleged Darwinian tree of evolution. This supposedly started out with the seed of the tree, the chance and naturalistic origin of the first living cell, which then branched off into the plant kingdom, into the animal kingdom, and eventually, at the highest branch, the man himself. Now, it's very important to notice that the evolutionists teach that at this particular juncture here, there was a common ancestor of both apes and man, and it branched off into a branch that led to the currently living great apes, and it branched off into a branch that led to modern human beings. That's why we have apes and humans living together at the same time. They evolved in parallel. So you should never ask the question, well, if man evolved from apes, why are there still apes? According to evolution, they didn't evolve directly from apes. They evolved from a common ancestor, an important distinction. Now, it is trouble for them, though, because that means apes living today or apes in the fossil record are not direct physical proof of human evolution. Why? Because they're on a trajectory and on a branch that never led to human beings. Therefore, they didn't evolve into humans. Therefore, they're a different kind, as the Bible would say. God created humans, created apes. They're separate. And guess what we see in the fossil record in the world today? They're separate. They need to find something on this branch here, something half ape and half man, which we'd call a transitional hominid. And as we shall see today, there is scarcely any convincing evidence whatsoever that that is the case. Now, first of all, we have a right to ask, does this tree really exist? I don't care what the textbook it's in or who the editors or who the scientists are who contributed to it. Many fallacies and flaws have been put in textbooks. Just because it's in a textbook does not by any means mean that it's true. So we have a right to ask the question, is there such a tree just because it exists in a textbook? According to the Bible, no. According to the Bible, there is nobody in our family tree except for Adam and his descendants. We never had any connection with the animal kingdom. We were individually, separately, supernaturally created. Man alone is said to be created in the image of God, a distinction even the angels cannot lay claim to. So let's look at this tree and see if it really makes sense when it comes to demonstrable, experimental, and concrete scientific evidence. First of all, we find right at the get-go, we cannot account for the seed of the tree. That's a fatal flaw if ever there was one. Without a seed, you logically cannot get a tree. Now, in Darwin's day, it was thought this is not a great problem. The crude microscopes of the 1800s, they made the cell look kind of like a gelatinous, amorphous blob that didn't have any great complexity at all. And they thought, well, it's just so simple. You know, this gelatinous mass could have just fallen together by chance, and then once it's living and reproducing, natural selection can do its magic, and after billions of years, presto, here we are. Well, they fail on the all-important first step. Logically, if the theory fails here, the whole theory is dead. Because if you can't get the first species, then you cannot get it to evolve into all the other species, including the human species. It's logically incumbent upon them they've got to have that first species. The theory is supposed to explain the origin of species. Well, if they can't explain the origin of the first species, then neither can it evolve into any other species. Now, based on what we know, it is mathematically, chemically, physically, and thermodynamically impossible for that first seed of life to have evolved from non-living chemicals. All the experiments done since the landmark experiment of Stanley Miller in 1953, more than half a century ago, you might wonder why they still have that experiment in 21st century textbooks. It's more than half a century old. The answer is obvious. If they had anything better, they would put it in there. But nobody has really done anything really substantially better than Miller, and Miller didn't get any significant results. He used artificial conditions, he put in a trap there. Intelligent design was used to, you know, get a higher yield using that trap, used the wrong atmosphere. And even with all this cheating, neither he nor anyone else in the history of science has produced all the necessary chemical compounds. Not all 20 alpha amino acids required for life, not all 4 nucleotides required for DNA and RNA, not the essential fatty acids and lipids required for cell membrane structure. You can get some here and some there with different experiments, but nobody gets all of them at the same place at the same time, using any kind of raw energy, interacting on any kind of chemical environment. It's never been achieved. Therefore, there exists no concrete experimental basis to believe that it ever could happen. Every imaginable scenario has been tried and failed abysmally. So it's mathematically, chemically, physically, thermodynamically impossible based on what we know. They believe it on the basis of evidence that we don't know. Evidence that does not exist, but they only hope someday it might exist. But in the meantime, they talk about it as if it were a fact. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. I quote here Paul Davies, very renowned and outspoken evolutionist. He says, and he's very knowledgeable on this subject, I should say, he says it's a shame that there are precious few hard facts when it comes to the origin of life. The how part has everybody stumped, including himself. Nobody knows how a mixture of lifeless chemicals spontaneously organized themselves into the first living cell. I didn't put those words in his mouth. That's true. Those type of cogent, straightforward admissions should be in our textbooks, they should be in the media, instead of the propaganda that we constantly get. Now, what does that mean? That means instead of having the seed on the tree of evolution, they ought to have a big question mark and nothing but negative feedback and failed experiments for more than half a century. I've never heard of any field of science where you have more than half a century of negative feedback and they still insist on talking about it as if it's a proven fact when all the experiments have failed. There's got to be some agenda behind that. It really has nothing to do with science. So that's a lethal flaw. It's kind of like having a man up here on the platform, laying down on his back. And I walk up to him and I look at him. I notice his t-shirt says, "I'm Mr. Evolution." And I have my evolutionist friend with me. And I say, "You know, look at Mr. Evolution here. It looks like he's bought the farm. It looks like he's dead as a doornail." And my evolutionist friend says, "Oh, no, it can't be. He must live." And I say, "Well, I think he's dead because you'll notice there's a stake right through his heart. And that's usually fatal. In fact, it's always fatal." And he says, "Well, yeah, but that's kind of nitpicky. You'll notice the stake has not impacted any of his other organs, just his heart." Now, I'm not kidding. That is literally what the evolutionists do. "Well, yeah, we have a weak link here. We have a little problem here. But, you know, everywhere else we got good stuff." Wait a minute, logically. If the heart is destroyed, the lifeblood cannot flow to the other organs. All the other organs are impacted. All the other organs die as well. And if you can't get the first species, it affects the whole theory because it can't evolve into any other species. If they can't get that all-important first species, their theory is dead. It's fatally flawed. How many fatal flaws does a theory have to have before it's no longer credible? Just one will do. Just one. But it gets worse. We not only have that fatal flaw, we find this tree has no trunk to support it. Why? Because in the living world and in the fossil record, we have the most unimaginable, the most huge and gargantuan, the most unexpected, and the most lethal gap you could ever imagine in the world of biology and paleontology. It jumps from single-celled organisms to multi-million-celled organisms of every major class and phylum in the animal kingdom. I mean, there's nothing in between. There's no 2-celled, 3-celled, 4-celled, 5-celled, 10-celled, 50-celled, 100-celled, 500-celled, 1,000-celled, 10,000-celled, 100,000-celled, finally, multi-million-celled creatures. Single cells, multi-million-celled creatures, every major distinct body plan. Explodes on the scene as if somebody spoke, and it was done. Somebody commanded, and it stood fast. Yeah, it looks like supernatural creation. It screams out of the fossil record and the living world. So here we have an amazing thing. Millions of years worth of evolution is supposed to take on. Millions times millions of these creatures should have lived and died, leaving an ample fossil record. Yet there's nothing in between these extremes. So what do they call it? The Big Bang of biology. Well, I'm sorry, you can call it a Big Bang, but 10 to 15 million years is still a long time. And there should have been millions of these creatures preserved. Now, some of them tried to say, well, they would have been soft-bodied, and so they just didn't get preserved. So it just looks like it didn't happen. It's just that the evidence didn't get preserved. Well, wait a minute. We find bacteria and algae, these very tiny, delicate little creatures, fossilized all over the world. We find jellyfish, snails, worms, soft-bodied invertebrates, fossilized all over the world. The Ediacaran Cambria, or the Ediacaran fauna, first found in Ediacara, Australia, all soft-bodied creatures. They've now been found in 5 different continents. How is it that good old Mother Nature has such a prejudice against evolutionary ancestors and transitions that it preserves billions of fossils in every continent of the planet, but not the ancestors and the missing links? A little hard to believe. Now, that means we have a gap here that is absolutely fatal. It's simply inconceivable, impossible that all this evolution could have gone on. This is where we have the richest fossil record, so we should have plenty of evidence. Number 2, this is where the biggest changes in the history of evolution are supposed to have taken place. right here. No other major category called a phyla ever evolved after this. That means 75 to 80% of the big scale evolution ever happened here. So here where the biggest events happened, the biggest changes happened, here where we have the richest fossil record, we have literally nothing showing any evolution. And there's no disputing. They never say, here's the evidence. We finally found it. Here it is. All the argument revolves around lame excuses as to why the evidence does not exist. But nobody just says, here's the evidence. It isn't there. That cuts the head right off the theory. That's a fatal gap. So Mr. Evolution prostrate here, I say, you know, to my evolutionist friend, I think Mr. Evolution is doubly dead. He not only has a stake through his heart, I notice his head is severed and his neck is missing. And we don't know where his neck is. People say, you know, it was soft tissue and it didn't get preserved, but his neck is missing. And there's his head. And again, oh, it can't be. It's just not possible that Mr. Evolution could be dead. But wait a minute. Look, notice his fingers are twitching. His toes are twitching. There's a spark of life. There's hope. We'll just give him CPR and he'll be fine. That's what you call denial of reality. Denial, denial, denial. Well, you know, there's the denial in Egypt, but there's a lot of denial in evolutionism, too. But anyway, if the head is severed, nerves can continue to fire off, and yes, you can wiggle your fingers and your toes. But you know what? If your head is severed and your neck is missing, and we don't even know where it is to reconnect it, you can't give the fellow CPR and revive him. He is dead as a doormat. It's a hopeless predicament. And this fingers and toes twitching, that's trivial. The evolutionists will often say, well, yeah, we got problems down here with the seed. We got problems with the trunk. But up here, we think we got some pretty good evidence. Wait a minute. You have to earn the right to even talk about that. You first explain how he can live when there's a stake through his heart and with his head cut off and his neck missing. I don't care about his toes twitching. Yeah. You can talk about that after you explain how he can live in his predicament. Once you've explained that, you've earned the right to go on. But when we have two fatal flaws and the whole theory is fatally kaput, they haven't earned the right to say anything else. The theory is dead. It has two fatal flaws right from the get-go. Now, in essence, what's going on here is that they're now saying, well, evolution must have happened in just the right way that it didn't leave any evidence. It just kind of junk. Isn't that interesting? You know, if you went into a court of law and tried that, you'd get thrown out on your ear. Well, Your Honor, we know that the defendant here is guilty of capital murder. The judge says, yes, but Mr. District Attorney, you've got a problem. In this court, we require evidence, not just prejudicial theories against the defendant. We want some evidence. You got any eyewitnesses? No, Your Honor. Do you have any forensic evidence? Blood, hair, fingerprints, footprints, DNA? No, Your Honor, we have nothing. We have no eyewitnesses to connect him to the scene of the crime. We have no forensic evidence to prove he was even in the city where the murder took place. But we have this theory, Your Honor. We have this theory that this man is a criminal genius. And, you know, he stole a car so he couldn't be identified. He put on a disguise. He came under cover of darkness so no eyewitnesses could identify him. And then before he did the crime, he put on a hazmat suit to make sure he wouldn't leave any skin flakes or hair or DNA of any kind or fingerprints. And he did the perfect crime without leaving any incriminating evidence. And since we have figured out this marvelous theory of how he did the perfect crime, leaving no incriminating evidence, Your Honor, you just have to find him guilty. The judge would say, you see this book of the law? I'm going to throw it at you. You get the Sam Hill out of my court. You come back when you've got some evidence and not just prejudicial theories against the defendant. But that's all the evolutionists have. They have a prejudice against the God of the Bible and his word and his truth that the rocks cry out. But when it comes to concrete, real evidence that would hold up in a court of law, it would never pass. And if it can't hold up in a court of law, it ought not to be in our textbooks. What about the remainder of the tree, these branches? Do they connect? Well, not according to Stephen Gould of Harvard University. Prior to his recent death in 2002, he was perhaps the world's leading spokesman for evolution. And an expert in paleontology, he said, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. It's like us professional paleontologists, us fossil scientists, we know the secret, but we don't want you ignorant masses finding out the truth. So it's our little pet secret. And what is that trade secret? That the evolutionary trees, as we have here, that adorn our textbooks, have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference. What's another word for inference? wishful thinking. Basically, just believing what you want to believe according to your preconceived idea. Inferring that this must be true because I already believe that. But notice, when it comes to concrete evidence, he says it's not the evidence of fossils. It's not concrete. It's just prejudiced inference. So, Paul Davies says we can't have the seed. George Gaylord Simpson, one of the greatest evolutionists of the 20th century, he said this Eocambrian problem, this Cambrian explosion, all the major phyla, no ancestors, no transitions, he said this is the major mystery of the history of life. Well, I've got news for him. It may be a mystery if you believe in evolution. Certainly not a mystery if you believe in biblical creation. It's exactly what you expect to see in the living world and in the fossil record if the Bible is literally true. Alfred Romer of Harvard looked at it and said, boy, you know, this would reasonably be consistent with the idea of special creation, supernatural creation. We probably got excommunicated from the evolutionary fraternity for making such an honest admission. It does look like special creation. It doesn't look like evolution. So according to Paul Davies, George Gaylord Simpson, and now Stephen Jay Gould, we don't have the seed, the trunk, and we don't even have any connecting branches on this alleged factual tree of Darwinian evolution. You've got to ask yourself the question, what kind of tree has no seed to grow from, no trunk to support it, and no branches connecting? A non-existent tree, a fairy tale tree, a wannabe tree, but certainly not a concrete scientific tree. What we actually see is exactly what biblical creation predicts. Distinct kinds of beautifully engineered designed plants and animals, varying only horizontally within their kind, never information-gaining macroevolution, though. That would take millions of years, no one could see it anyway. But what we actually see is what the Bible predicts we will see. Nonetheless, the evolutionists use that alleged tree to put quotes like this in our textbooks at taxpayer expense. You are an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms. Wonderful. Well, you know, it's kind of hard on the human ego to think that we're ultimately the end product of this equation, slime plus time equals you. Or, as others have put it, we're the end product of from goo to you by way of the zoo. But this is the direct inference of evolution. You are nothing but a product of chance, complex bag of chemicals thrown together by the whims of nature, nothing supernatural involved, no creator. Therefore, you have no purpose, no value, no dignity, and no destiny. When you ask the most profound human questions that man has pondered from the dawn of time, questions like, who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose and meaning and value in life? How do I determine what is right and what is wrong? And what's going to happen to me when I die? Do I have any hope of life beyond the grave? Do I have a spiritual nature? Evolution says no to all those questions. No, you're a complex bag of chemicals. Like other animals, you're thrown together by chance. And therefore, you ask the question, who are you? Why are you here? The answer is, you're nothing. You're nobody. You are not created with any ordained plan or purpose or value or meaning. You'll just live and you'll die, and that'll be the end of you. And since you have no spiritual nature to survive the grave, you will never even remember you ever existed. The human population has no ultimate greater significance than a swarm of flies, which also supposedly evolved by chance and will eventually go extinct, like all living creatures go extinct with time. So, you have no purpose, no value, no dignity, no destiny, and when you die, you won't even have the memory that you existed. You might have been a wonderful person. You might have been king of the world. You might have been very popular. But when you die and everyone else dies, they'll never remember you ever existed. You might have been like Jimmy Stewart. You might have had a wonderful life. But it doesn't matter. When you die, the memory dies too. You will never know you ever existed. Your life is meaningless, purposeless, worthless, hopeless. So, have a nice day. That's the philosophy of despair that evolution offers us. And you might wonder, why would anybody want to believe that? Why would anybody want to believe the philosophy of hopelessness and despair? Well, the Bible tells us that there are those who would sell their birthright for a bowl of beans. Esau did that. He had a sacred birthright, but he was more concerned about feeding his belly, the lust of his flesh, and he took something of lasting sacred value and sold it. We have been judged to be worthy of eternal life. We have been judged to be the children of the Father and the bride of Christ if we'll just accept it by faith and turn from our sin. God has already made that judgment. Jesus has already died and risen from the dead. But we can veto the judgment of God. We can judge ourselves unworthy of eternal life. Like Paul said of the Jews, you know, since you judge yourselves unworthy of eternal life, I'll go to the Gentiles. A tragedy being God has judged us worthy of eternal life, but we can say, no, I'd rather have my bowl of beans. I'd rather sell my birthright. I'd rather disavow my identity that I was made in the image of God. Because if I'm just the product of slime plus time, I can do whatever I want, indulge in the pleasures of sin without a conscience, and then hope like crazy there is no God. Because if you're living like there is no God, men and women, you'd be very sure that you're right. If there's any chance at all that the Bible is true, there's hell to pay and heaven to gain. And it's an awful risk. Couldn't be any higher stakes than your life for eternity. And why there is such a mystery of iniquity that men reject the truth and believe the philosophy of hopelessness and despair just so they can indulge in the pleasures of sin and disavow their birthright is a mystery, as the scripture says, the mystery of iniquity. But the good news is we're not compelled by overwhelming evidence to believe that philosophy of hopelessness and despair. The most reasonable interpretation of the data is we were created in the image of an omniscient, omnipotent creator, and his fingerprints are all over this creation, and they're especially all over human beings, with intellect, emotion, will, powers of abstract thought, spirituality, morality. How do you ever get things like that out of dead dirt? The law of cause and effect says for every effect there must be an adequate cause, and no effect can be greater than its cause. They're getting everything from nothing, and all these attributes we have from dirt, and somehow have perversely claimed it's more scientific to believe that than to believe Genesis. Well, not in my book. Now, there are three major strikes against evolution right from the get-go. Strike number one, Theodosius Dobzhansky, the greatest evolutionist of the 20th century, he said that it's impossible to observe real Darwinian evolution, real macroevolution. That takes millions of years. Nobody lives long enough to see it. That's a problem, because if you can't see it and observe it, it's really not science. It's faith, philosophy, or religion. But he says it's impossible to observe real Darwinian evolution. Secondly, mutation and selection mechanism is effectively dead, according to Stephen Gould of Harvard University. To his credit, he said mutations are random changes in the genetic language, like typographical errors. They garble and destroy information. They don't make it new and better. So we need to have a better mechanism. He never found one. He died 22 years after he said this, having never found anything better. Third, no single watertight transitional fossil is known, according to Dr. Colin Patterson, former senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History. He had at his disposal one of the greatest assemblages of fossils available to any scientist in the world. He wrote a whole book on evolution, but he didn't give a single example, living or fossil, of a transitional creature. When asked why, he said, well, if I knew of any, I certainly would have put them in my book, but I don't know of any. So he says there's not any that's a watertight example. There's a handful that the evolutionists will argue about, but there should be millions. It should be truckloads in every museum. It should be happening today. But all they can do is argue over a few disputable ones that even many evolutionists don't accept. That's what you'd expect to see if creation is true. Now, that's 1, 2, 3 strikes you're out, but the evolutionists say, wait a minute, we'll quibble with this last point here. We may not have transitions, especially at the trunk of the tree where the biggest evolution in history took place, but guess what? We got a whole slew of them up here from an ape-like ancestor to man. Now, somebody ought to smell a rat there. Where the biggest evolution happened, they have nothing, and they have to admit that because there's nothing there. But here, from an ape-like ancestor to man, they have a whole slew of them. We have the right to ask the question, where did you get these pictures from? These aren't photographs, they're drawings. Why don't you have photographs of ape men? I can't seem to find ape men running around to photograph, I guess. So they're drawings. What are they based on? Fossil evidence. How much? In almost all cases, we're dealing with fragmentary evidence where they get to make up the rest from their own imagination. When we get a nearly complete fossil skeleton, it's bad news for them because you can jolly well tell whether it's an ape or a man. There's enough skeleton there we can see clearly. A layman can see whether it's an ape or a man. Now, these transitions are erected out of the twilight zone of fragmentary evidence where the experts get to add the rest by their own biased imagination. All we have to do is look at their track record to see that that's really what's been going on. We'll take a look at Nebraska Man, found in western Nebraska in 1922. Major find, hadn't found a transitional hominid in the Western Hemisphere before, and so this was big stuff. Illustrated in the Illustrated London News, disseminated around the world. When they made this picture, used it in our textbooks, used it in college, used it in the famous Scopes monkey trial. Expert depositions of evidence read into the court record, one of their star witnesses, Nebraska Man. When all this happened, they did not have in their possession a complete skeleton, a complete skull, or even a complete jaw. All they did have in its entirety was a single molar tooth. It was the tooth and the whole tooth, but nothing but the tooth. And You've got to ask the question, how can they get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth out of a single tooth? Well, I don't know, but they said they were such experts in forensic science, anatomy, and anthropology that they could get all that evidence, and if you disagreed, you're ignorant and backwards and uneducated. Well, I'd like to know what are the tactics used to ascertain the details of the sketch. Well, I think this is how they did it. If you squeeze a tooth long enough and hard enough, you can force it to confess to anything. And I think they just squeezed that tooth until it squealed and told them anything they wanted to hear. For example, how do we know the man walked semi-erect? I don't know, a tooth could tell you a man's posture, but if you squeeze it hard enough, it'll tell you what you want to hear. How do we know that this man had the brain power or IQ to make this stone implement in his hand or this wooden club? I don't know, a tooth could tell you a man's IQ, but I guess if you squeeze hard enough, you can get the answer. They even knew what his face looked like. Rather a homely visage. Only a mother could love such a face as that. But they knew what that homely face looked like. The tooth told all. They squeezed just a little bit harder, and the tooth even divulged what his wife looked like right there. Wow. Wow, the tooth knew everything about the man and his family. Well, that's how it went until full examination results were done. They dug deeper, got the rest of the fossil a few years later. The results published in Scientific American magazine, December 16, 1927. The article read, Nebraska man turned out to be neither an ape nor a man. It actually turned out to be a pig, a peccary, an extinct wild pig. In fact, they found that pig living today. It's one of those so-called living fossils. Well, this, of course, could be excused because everybody makes mistakes, including creationists. That's why we need to rely on God. He's perfect. We aren't. But this isn't just some, you know, minor mistake they made once. This is symptomatic of what's been going on ever since Darwin. They keep making the same mistake. And it's because their pride, their prejudice, their preconceived ideas colors how they interpret the data. Getting a PhD doesn't make you objective. In fact, the Bible says it can be worse. It says that knowledge puffs up and makes one prideful, but love edifies. Well, another classic example of this historically is Piltdown Man, based on fossil specimens found by Charles Dawson near Piltdown, England in the year 1912. Primarily a skull cap, skull remnants with a jawbone with some teeth in it. The skull appeared very human-like. The jawbone appeared very ape-like, except for the wear pattern on the teeth was more human than ape. So Charles Dawson thought, Eureka, half man, half ape, the missing link is no longer missing. And as a result, from 1912 to 1953, Piltdown Man reigned supreme in our textbooks and museums. Scores of books and pamphlets, articles were published about Piltdown Man. It was used again in the famous Scripps Monkey Trial as proof the Bible is false, the evolution is true. Until 1953. By then, they came up with a new dating method based on absorption of fluoride out of the environment in the fossil bones. And they thought, well, we'll test it. It's supposed to be about 500,000 years old based on evolutionary presumption. But he said, well, we'll test it and see exactly how old it is. And they were shocked. The jawbone had such a little trace of it, and it's no more than you'd find in a living creature. The skull had a bit more. It might have been several centuries old, but certainly not 500,000 years old. So they ran up the red flag. Something is amiss. We better run a battery of tests. After all, it might be a forgery. It might be a fraud. Brilliant deduction. After more than four decades of trumpeting, it's an unassailable fact that proves the Bible is false. They get a little humility and say, we better run some tests. But when they did, they found out these weren't even ancient fossils at all. They not only didn't have enough fluoride, they were simply chemically painted on the surface to make them look like ancient stained fossils. Then with no more than a magnifying glass, they looked at the teeth. And they could see distinct scratch marks on the teeth where someone had taken a hand file and filed down what turned out to be orangutan teeth, trying to make them look more human in their wear pattern. Piltdown Man was 100% deliberate forgery and fraud. In retrospect, they said it was so poorly done, whoever did it must have been in a big hurry because they didn't seem to have the time to do a decent job. Yet this poorly constructed fraud sat under the noses of some of the world's greatest educated experts in the field, and none of them could see it for what it really was. What was the problem? Lack of education or lack of an open mind? This was the goose that laid the golden egg. This was what they desperately wanted, and they were blinded to the truth. Because it so beautifully fit their preconceived ideas. So when people say, oh, we just have to trust the scientists, they're searching for truth. Remember, a PhD doesn't get rid of a sinful, wicked heart. A PhD doesn't get rid of the human frailties of pride and prejudice and preconceived ideas. So Piltdown Man is now recognized as one of the most spectacular and longest enduring frauds in the history of modern science. And the legacy continues. After Piltdown Man went down into the history of ill repute, he was replaced more recently with Boxgrove Man, the earliest Englishman. Well, Boxgrove Man, look how they've reconstructed him. They must have a lot of evidence. What did they have? One shin bone. And it was a shin bone that looked like a modern shin bone. Imagine if you got buried and after a few centuries there's nothing but your shin bone left and they dig it up and they make you look like this. That's essentially what they've done. They use artistic license to give the picture of evolution even though the evidence shows it not one iota. It's a modern human shin bone. Eosimius, the alleged Don Simeon, common ancestor perhaps of apes and man. They claim, boy, they must have a lot of evidence for this. Carnegie Museum of Natural History got this beautiful illustration. What evidence do they have? They have a couple of jawbones. That's it. A couple of pieces of jawbone. How big are they? The size of grains of rice. And from that, these people, with their tremendous wisdom, in Time magazine, they wrote that this creature was shy, nocturnal, and had large saucer-like eyes and flitted about the treetops. I defy anybody, I don't care how many PhDs are behind your name, to prove that based on a couple of grain of rice-sized pieces of bone out of a jaw. But it goes to show these people act like they're above the law. Anything they say has to be gospel truth because they've got their credentials. Well, history is full of credentialed people that are dead wrong. In fact, I'll guarantee hell is full of PhDs. Because the broad path leads to destruction and knowledge puffs up. And if you don't humble yourself, it is so easy to miss the truth, being blinded by your own pride and prejudice and preconceived ideas. Ardipithecus ramidus gadaba, what a name for it. This alleged transitional hominid was based on these fragments. The main proof was this one particular single toe bone, okay? Very curved, very ape-like, really looks like nothing but an ape's toe bone. And where did they find that? 18 kilometers away from these other fragments in a different rock stratum. Where were the other ones found? They were found spread over an area of 15 kilometers long. So, this has prompted some people to ask the question, was this history's first suicide bomber? And indeed, was he carrying a nuclear bomb when it went off, since his remains were scattered all over the place? Well, evolutionist Nigel Locke, to his credit, admitted that few sciences produce such abundant returns from so few fragments of fact as paleontology. Now, Dr. Tim White, a notable world-class evolutionist paleoanthropologist, notice what he says about his colleagues in his own field. He says, a 5-million-year-old piece of bone that was thought to be the collarbone of a human-like creature is actually part of a dolphin rib. The problem with a lot of anthropologists is they want so much to find a hominid or ape man that any scrap of bone becomes a hominid bone. Well, if he admits that about his own colleagues, why should we blindly trust them? Oh, we've got our PhDs. Yeah, all these guys have PhDs. And they make, out of any scrap of bone, a hominid. And notice what he says. Any scrap bone becomes a hominid bone because that's how they get fame, fortune, research grants. That's how their career is assured. Now, ape men have been deduced from fragmentary bones, originally, which later were found to have belonged to an alligator, a horse, a bear, an elephant, a donkey, and as we just saw, even a dolphin. All of that is documented in my book, Evolution on Trial. Well, here in Time magazine, they have an alleged evolutionary hominid. Notice most of it's missing, filled in with wax or clay. How do we know the missing parts really look like that? Well, I guess we've got to trust these experts. After all, their track record is so good. Here we have the famous missing link Iceman. This is supposed to be a sub-Neanderthaloid hominid that fell into glacial ice and got deep frozen tens of thousands of years ago. Serendipity came along and he was found. The Smithsonian wanted to do x-rays of this, a little forensic analysis. The owner said, no way, Jose. You can look at it in the ice. You don't do any analysis. That ought to be a big red flag right there. If this was real, it would be worth any amount the owner would demand, and the evolutionists would give it to him. But the fact that they wouldn't allow any forensic analysis, that ought to be a big red flag. Nonetheless, some evolutionists wrote this up as proof of evolution. Most notable one, Bernard Heuvelmans of Belgium, internationally famous zoologist. He just looked at it in the ice, didn't do x-rays, didn't do a tissue sample or anything. It looked like a sub-Neanderthaloid hominid to me. Wrote it up as such, in his expert opinion. Well, he should have demanded the right to at least take a tissue sample because it turned out not to be an ape man at all. It was, in fact, just a rubber dummy, frozen in ice with bear's fur on it to look like an ape man. Well, we have the story of the Tasade Cavemen of the Philippines in Reader's Digest magazine under the title of The Greatest Hoaxes of All Time. This is said to be the most successful modern scientific hoax of the 20th century. This man, Manuel Elizalde in the Philippines, he realized there's so little evidence for human evolution that if you make a claim, it's usually embraced uncritically and few questions are asked. That's a good recipe for a successful fraud. So you ask these people in the Philippines, move out of your modern homes, take off your modern clothes, run around naked or wear leaves and loincloths. Move into these caves I found in the Philippine jungle. Use stone and wooden tools and speak some mumbo-jumbo language that only Elizalde supposedly had learned how to interpret. Then he calls up a news conference. I have found the anthropological discovery of the century. Men and women living in caves like our ancestors did tens of thousands of years ago. Well, the world beat a path through the door. National Geographic devoted a cover story to the Tasade cave people. NBC Television offered $50,000 to do a documentary. That was back in 1971 when the minimum wage was like $1.25 an hour. That was big money back then. Eventually, $20 million was laid aside to make the whole area a nature preserve, to preserve our Stone Age cousins in their natural habitat. That went to Ferdinand Marcos and probably Sundell Elizalde. When Marcos got booted out of the Philippines, a Swiss journalist came and wanted to find out more about the cavemen. He went there, nobody's there. He goes to the nearby village, what happened to the cavemen? What happened? They said, what happened? It was us. That Elizalde said he'd share the booty with us if we did this charade, and he took all the money and ran with it and didn't give us one red cent, and we're mad as can be. And they just spilled the beans. Yet to this day, there are evolutionists who stuck out their names, their necks, their reputations, fully endorsing this in the late 70s, early 80s, before the fraud was discovered. And to this day, they will not admit they got schnookered by a bunch of Filipinos in the jungle. They're too prideful to admit it. They just say they mysteriously disappeared, maybe aliens abducted them, who knows. But they're not about to admit that they were wrong. 21st century fraud. A leading Japanese archaeologist, whom colleagues had nicknamed God's Hands for his uncanny ability to know just where to dig to find ancient relics, has publicly admitted to faking his most recent discoveries. Shinichi Fujimura was renowned for discovering Japan's oldest sites of civilization, making front page news each time he found ever older artifacts. But a Japanese newspaper had secretly photographed Fujimura sneaking onto the site in the early morning, digging holes and burying stone implements, a few days before he and colleagues unearthed them and proudly announced the discovery to the media. After exposure, Fujimura apologized to the media, head bowed, saying, I can't imagine what made me do it. Well, I know what made him do it. The heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And a PhD doesn't get rid of that problem. If anything, it makes it worse and exacerbates it. This man loved the public adulation, the fame, the fortune, and he's willing to lie to get it. The only difference here is he got caught. How many times have they not got caught doing this? Don't just blindly trust scientists. The track record shows it's not a good bet. Now, another problem we have is reconstruction of partial anatomy. If we have just this dark section of jawbone, which is often all you find, you make it a U-shaped jaw, large canine teeth, large incisors, diastema gap for the top canines to fit in, it's nothing but an ape or a baboon. Nobody believes you evolved directly from them. It's no good as evidence for human evolution. However, if you reconstruct it up here with a parabolic shape, small incisors, small canines, no diastema gap, oh, you can call up and say, I found evidence of human evolution. Your name will be in papers worldwide. You'll get fame, fortune, public adulation. Your career is assured. And this, in my opinion, is the stock and trade of paleoanthropologists. They don't want a complete skeleton. You get a complete skeleton, everybody can tell it's just an ape or it's just a man. You get a little fragment, you get to make up the rest. And that's where the bread and butter is, in my opinion. Now, notice evolutionist Jay Shreve admits everybody knows fossils are fickle. Bones will sing any song you want to hear. They're just never allowed to sing the song of creation. This is the skull that made Louis B. Leakey famous. His famous Ginge Anthropus, or East Africa Man, or Nutcracker Man. Four different experts had different views of what it looked like. Doesn't matter, because now they all say it was just on a branch that led to apes. It had nothing to do. With his charisma and his winning personality, Leakey was able to get, at least some agreement with this in his day. But now they're saying it's just an ape. It booted out of the lineage of human beings. Nobody knows that problem worse than Ronald Irvin. Ronald Irvin is a born-again Christian, but he's a world-class medical and anatomical illustrator for textbooks and biology and medicine. And because of his great expertise, he was put on a contract to draw pictures for a biology textbook. They asked him to draw a picture of the Lucy Afarensis ape woman. Well, he looked at the fragmentary evidence. He says, who knows what in the world she looked like? I got to draw something. So he drew this picture of her. He was then immediately regaled and castigated. They said, for crying out loud, don't you know that Lucy is an ape woman? You have made her look entirely too human. Why, she looks like some angry, homely woman we've all seen walking down the street now and then. You need to go back to the drawing board and make her look more like an ape woman. He said, okay, that's it. You can't fire me. I quit. If you're just going to have me here and pay me to draw pictures to support the theory of evolution, even when the evidence doesn't support it, that's it. I quit. But he blew the whistle on them. And he said, don't trust what you see in the textbooks. He says, I know firsthand the illustrator is pressured to draw what they want to see, irrespective of what the actual evidence indicates. Now here we have a close-up of the tree of evolution in the book Origins by Richard Leakey. It shows how an insect-eating mammal, an insectivore, supposedly branched off with the tarsus, lorsus, lemurs, the new and old world monkeys, and the great apes in the line that eventually supposedly led to modern man. Again, these branches don't exist in the real world or in the fossil record by concrete evidence. They're drawn by inference. We have these distinct different kinds. They infer evolution must have happened, therefore there must have been branches. But when you read the fine print, those branches are there by inference, not concrete evidence. Now, the line that supposedly led to man started with the alleged common ancestor of ape and man, something nobody has ever really found or can ever really agree on, the hominidae. So it's just a name on a chart, no real proof, supposedly 30 million years ago. Now, I don't believe in that time scale. But I'll tell you this much. If they had 30 million years of these creatures living and dying, there ought to be plenty of evidence. And they can't find anything they can agree on. Then we go to Rhomopithecus, Australopithecus, Homo erectus, finally Homo sapien, which means man the wise. Well, Rhomopithecus, or the ape of Rama, all we had of him for many years was a couple of jaw fragments. You know, but that's more than a single tooth, isn't it? David Pilbeam and Ellen Simons, American paleoanthropologists, they said, that's good enough. We need an early ancestor. This'll do. So they went from this to this, that our early ancestor in our textbooks and museums. But what happened here is classic. They make these grandiose, extravagant claims on the basis of incredibly fragmentary evidence. Then, when more complete evidence comes to light, it turns out to be nothing but an ape, and it gets booted out of the human lineage. This happened with Oreopithecus, Kenyopithecus, Sipipithecus, and now Rhomopithecus. The more recent evidence that they got, compared to a chimpanzee skull and orangutan there on the left, in the center, the more complete skull evidence of Rhomopithecus, showing the angle of the face, like the orangutan. Orbital ridge, like the orangutan, the mastoid process on the side, like the orangutan, the tooth and jaw morphology, very similar to the orangutan. So much so that David Pilbeam and Ellen Simons, the main champions of the alleged transitional status of Rhomopithecus, they got up and publicly recanted, publicly ate humble pie and said, we wanted this to be our early ancestor. It appears it's nothing but an ancient orangutan, an ape. And nobody believes we evolved directly from apes. These are what orangutans look like. And these orangutans seem to think it's funny they were mistaken for being human ancestors. Okay. Now, what does that mean? On Richard Leakey's chart, we start with no common ancestor that they can agree with. Our early ancestor, Rhomopithecus, turns out to be just an orangutan, therefore not in the branch that leads to human beings, so he has to be crossed off the chart. That means we start with nothing. We go for several million years of alleged human evolution with nothing to show for it, until we come to the Australopithecines. Now, austral in Latin means southern, like Australia, the southern continent. Pithecus in ape, or in Greek, means ape. So the name tells you what it is, southern ape. First found in 1924 by Dr. Raymond Dart, who gave it the appropriate name, southern ape. Well, in the 20s, they thought they'd find something much better than that. They didn't. So they go back to the southern ape. All of a sudden, it's half human. So there's evolution going on here. It's evolution in the description of the creature. But it has, as you can see, a massive jaw, big mastoid processes, big orbital ridges, low vaulted skull, forehead, sagittal crest, all the diagnostic indications of nothing but an ape. Even the more gracile female form is decidedly ape-like. And I'm not the only one to notice that. Dr. Ashley Montague of Princeton, a world-class evolutionist anthropologist by any estimation, he has never accepted the Australopithecines, which is probably why he never gets quoted in textbooks or the media. But he is a world-class expert. He said, the skull form of all Australopithecines is extremely ape-like. The Australopithecines show too many specialized and ape-like characteristics to be either the direct ancestor of man or of the line that led to man. There's nothing but an extinct ape. In fact, it appears we have four living great apes today. The gibbons, the orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. Apparently, there was a fifth type of great ape in the past that's gone extinct. We call it the Australopithecine ape. And they keep digging up this ape, but it really is nothing but an ape. And to his credit, Ashley Montague realized that decades ago. Another expert in this field, Lord Salley Zuckerman, first knighted by the Queen of England, then raised to the title of Lord in recognition of his scientific achievements, he said, I myself remain totally unpersuaded. Almost always when I have tried to check the anatomical claims on which the status of Australopithecus is based, I have ended in failure. The Australopithecine skull is in fact so overwhelmingly simian, which means ape-like, as opposed to human. But the contrary proposition could be equated to an assertion that black is white. Now, here we have the Australopithecine spoken most about in the last several decades. Lucy, so named because the Beatles tune Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was playing on the tape player when they first found it over there in Africa with the Donald Johanson team. They've always said we got 40% of the postcranial skeleton. But if you count these bones, there's 206 bones in the human body. They only have 20%. And we ask them, why do you keep saying 40%? Oh, you notice that. Well, you see, we hardly ever find the foot bones of hominids. And so we just didn't count any of the foot bones. And so then it's 40%. Well, why don't you tell the students if you don't count all the foot bones, then it's 40%? Because really, you only have 20%. But you'll notice this hip bone here, how it flares out to the side. That's very ape-like. Apes have hip bones that flare out to the side. Humans are curved more inward. Now, at first, Arnold Johansson said, oh, it doesn't matter, it could walk as good as a modern human. And then he kept looking at that hip bone and he said, no, she couldn't walk upright that way. But I know what happened. I think a deer stepped on the bone and deformed it. And so he made an exact cast replica of it. He sent it to his colleague, Owen Lovejoy. And on a BBC special, first aired in Australia and New Zealand, they showed his colleague, Owen Lovejoy, taking a power saw and cutting this thing to pieces. He then glued it back together in a human-like fashion and said, see, this is how it ought to look. And now she walks upright. Even the secular media took them to task and said, these scientists act like they're above the law, but they can do anything. Cut, you know, evidence into pieces and reconstruct it to look the way they want in their own imagination and pretend that's scientific. Well, I'm glad the secular media also recognized how illegitimate that is. But believe me, they'll get away with anything. You give them an inch, they'll take a mile. They act like they're above the law. Now, here we have the skull of Lucy's species, not Lucy herself, but of her species, Australopithecus afarensis, and it is grossly ape-like, as to be expected. When we compare it with the chimpanzee and the human, we find humans have a parabolic dental arcade. However, apes often have a U-shaped jaw with a diastema gap. Guess what? So does Lucy. Notice this hole here, foramen magnum, where the spinal column attaches to the skull. Well, in humans, it's located near the center. This allows upright posture, upright locomotion. Notice in apes like the chimp, it's closer to the rear of the skull, giving a more ape-like posture. Notice in Lucy, it's much closer than even it is with a chimpanzee, which should indicate she had a more grossly ape-like posture than even some apes living today. When we look at the shoulder socket, that's a tongue twister there. She sells seashell by the seashore. Anyway, the shoulder socket and shoulder blade assembly. According to Lovejoy and Ronald Johansson, Lucy, from the neck down, was human. A hairy human body, small, about 3.5 feet tall. Modern human anatomy. We don't see that, though. She had a definitely ape-like configuration to her shoulder blade, shoulder socket, angled to the right, meaning that she was designed for reaching up and grabbing trees constantly. An arboreal lifestyle. It should have looked like this, human, only smaller. But it didn't. And what about the ear hole? When we look at the ear hole on apes, we find they have a large exterior ear hole compared to humans. We have a small ear hole, but it's what's on the inside that counts. The semicircular canal system of the balance mechanism of the inner ear is very large in humans, giving us a tremendous sense of balance. So we can walk and run upright without falling on our face all the time. We can do Olympic ice skating and gymnastics, as amazing abilities we have. Apes live in the trees and use all four appendages. Their feet have a prehensile toe. It's like a thumb. And so they don't need that great sense of balance because they can coordinate with all four limbs. When they come down on the ground, they lock their wrists and they knuckle walk. Again, all fours. They don't need the balance system humans have. Guess what? Lucy is supposed to walk every bit as good as a modern human. They looked into her skull with MRIs and CAT scans, found out she had exactly the same type of semicircular canal balance mechanism of the apes. Not halfway between ape and man, not human, just like other apes. She could not have walked any better than any other ape because she did not have the balance capability. Finally, I quote here the man who is arguably the world's greatest expert on computerized analysis, multivariate analysis of bones using computers and x-rays and 3D cyber techniques. Dr. Charles Oxnard, he first pioneered this back in the 70s. Former professor of anatomy and anthropology at the University of Chicago, then at USC, currently at the University of Western Australia. Although an evolutionist, he said now with the new finds we've had and put through this analysis, we could say the Australopithecines known over the last several decades are now irrevocably removed from a place in the evolution of human bipedalism, walking upright in two legs in a human fashion, possibly from a place in a group any closer to humans than to African apes, and certainly from any place in the direct human lineage. The analysis has showed they're nothing but an extinct type of fifth grade ape, nothing more, period. Now, you wouldn't know that to look in the textbooks. They have Lucy here with the ape skull, sure enough, but a hairy human body, human hands, human wrist, human ankle, human big toe and foot. Well, guess what? We have found those extremity bones in recent years, and it's been devastating. We find that Lucy had long curved fingers and toes, typical of tree-dwelling apes. She had locking wrists. When they come down out of the trees, they lock their wrists and walk on their knuckles. One article by an evolutionist said, it's not Lucy in the sky with diamonds, it's Lucy on the ground with knuckles. Well, that's what the evidence shows. Wrong talus angle. The angle of the bone connecting the lower leg to the ankle is the right angle for climbing up trees habitually, but not walking upright habitually in a human fashion. And we finally found her foot fossilized in a stalactite, or stalagmite, I should say. And it was an ape-like foot. a foot with a big prehensile toe like this. Not a human foot. Only humans have feet like humans. Even a dancing bear doesn't have a foot like a human. Only humans do. Lucy's was decidedly ape-like. This has been devastating. Perhaps the worst thing. In recent years, they found what's called Lucy's Child. They estimate about a 3-year-old Australopithecine. And they found it a number of years ago, but they keep excavating more and more of it out. It's the most complete Lucy afarensis Australopithecine skeleton we've ever found, and that's always devastating. When you get a complete skeleton, it's the worst nightmare for evolutionists. Because now we can see how all the bones connect, and it is decidedly ape-like. It's not halfway between ape and man. It's decidedly ape. If we were living today, we would say it's just another great ape. Recently, in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, 3 evolutionist scientists co-authored a paper, passed peer review at the National Academy, and they basically said just that. We have enough evidence. There's no longer any reason to be barking up the wrong tree. We were running up a blind alley all these decades. We had to come clean and realize all the Australopithecines, including Lucy, are nothing but an extinct form of great ape. And if you're living today, we would recognize they're nothing but apes. And so we need to look for something better. They didn't used to do that, but now it's becoming very obvious. Now notice here, in National Geographic, they have a reconstruction from the bones, the fossil bones, to Lucy. Anybody knows anything interesting about Lucy here? No apes have whites in their eyes. Only humans have whites in their eyes. Notice in the evidence, there are no eyes. But the artist knew that she had whites in her eyes. Interesting thing, you know, if you're on Bunker Hill and say, don't shoot till you see the whites of their eyes, the apes are coming after you, they'll never shoot. They have no whites in their eyes. But anyway, he admitted his bias. He said, I wanted to get a human soul into this ape-like face to indicate something about where she was headed. As if he knows by looking at some dead bone where she was headed. It's just his philosophy, his preconceived idea, coming across with artistic license, but not based on concrete proof. Homo habilis or handyman, Louis Leakey again lobbied for this with his charismatic personality. But many evolutionists today admit that it is an invalid taxon. This past peer review was published in Nature magazine, arguably the most prestigious science journal in the world. Invalid taxon, a mixture of more than one fossil type. Some ape bones, some human bones. That's a good way to get an ape man. You mix ape bones and human bones, you get an ape man. But it's not legitimate. And so they admit it's invalid. Well, if it's invalid, why do they still have it in the textbooks? One honest evolutionist gave a very straightforward answer. He said, if there weren't a Homo habilis, we would have to invent one. So we might as well use the old invalid one, since we'd have to invent one if we get rid of it. Well, I guess that's logical, but it's not very reasonable. Okay, finally we come to Homo erectus. Good old Homo erectus. He looks kind of brutish and dirty and dim-witted and subhuman here, and that's always often reconstructed in Time magazine and other textbooks and things like that. But, you know, he lives up to his name. The name Homo erectus means upright man. And remember what I said? When you get a complete or nearly complete skeleton, you can jolly well tell it, whether it's an ape or a man. In the case of Homo erectus, we have the famous Turkana boy. They used to think he was 11 or 12 when he died. Now they're saying he might have been only 9 or 10 when he died. He's already 5'6" in stature. He easily could have been 6 foot tall or taller in adulthood. In fact, Homo erectus people, as an ethnic type, averaged in the males about 5'10", which is about the average even today. So his skeleton is a modern skeleton. It's not remotely ape-like. It's virtually indistinguishable from a modern human skeleton. They admit that. You have to be an expert to know any difference, and it's no more difference than you have within the different ethnic varieties of full human beings today. The skull is a human skull, not an ape skull. It is a little smaller and a little thicker, but again, this could be normal genetic variation within the human family with our rich gene pool. But it's well within the range for normal human intelligence. An individual in Africa only had 700 cubic centimeter cranial capacity, but had normal human intelligence. Some people get more than 3 times that, 2,200 cubic centimeters. But they don't have 3 times the IQ. They just have normal IQ. It's not the sheer size of the brain that imparts intelligence, it's the organization of the brain, which may explain why the African gray parrot with a little bird brain matches, in some cases surpasses, the cognitive abilities of the African chimpanzee with a much larger brain. It's the organization that counts. Most humans today average around 1,400 cubic centimeters. The Homo erectus ethnic tribe, which has gone largely extinct, like lots of nations and tribes go extinct over time, they average about 1,000 cubic centimeters, placing them well within the known range for normal human IQ. There's simply no reason to call them ape men other than they're desperate to have an ape man. Finally, we come to good old Neanderthal man. This poor guy's had a bad rap from the very beginning. First skeleton found in a cave in the Neander Valley near Dusseldorf, Germany, in the year 1856. And it was an old, diseased man suffering bone degenerative disease, bent over, not because he was part ape, but because of his deforming disease. A lot of them in Northern Europe apparently suffered from a chronic vitamin D and iodine deficiency and thus had bone-deforming diseases as a result. You get more toward the Middle East where they were healthier, had a better habitat, better nutrition, and they walk fully erect. They have skeletons that are a little different from ours, but distinctly human, not ape-like at all. And this differences that we could see could be due to great age. As Jack Quazzo has pointed out, if you lived to be a few hundred years old, you'd look like a Neanderthal. Certain parts of our anatomy grow as long as you live. And these could be some of these people the Bible talks about living three or four centuries after the flood, still living great lifespans. But it's definitely erect, it's definitely human, it's definitely not remotely ape-like. And in fact, the reconstruction in the American Museum of Natural History shows a guy that looks kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, give him a shave, a haircut, put him in camis, he'd be a good stunt double for Arnold Schwarzenegger. They even say if you give him a shave, bath, haircut, put him in a business suit, nobody would pay him any special attention. Now, I quote here Eric Trinkaus, arguably the world's greatest expert on Neanderthals and an evolutionist. He admits detailed comparison of Neanderthal skeletal remains with those of modern humans have shown that there is nothing in Neanderthal anatomy that conclusively indicates locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, or linguistic abilities inferior to those of modern humans. If he is not inferior to us, he is equal to us. Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other, logically. And yes, he's a different ethnic type, as we know from the breakup of the gene pool. At the dispersion of nations at Babel, you would have a lot of different ethnic types established shortly thereafter, but still human, still traced back to Adam. The Neanderthals may have gone extinct or been absorbed, but they were descendants of Adam just like you and I. Here we have the Neanderthal model endorsed by Eric Trinkaus, again, one of the world's greatest authorities. This guy doesn't look near so bad as those old reconstructions. Like one lady said, boy, this guy's handsome enough. You give him a shave, bath, haircut, put him in a tuxedo, I'd go out to dinner with him. He's really rather a handsome bloke. Okay, here we have a forensic reconstruction of a Neanderthal child. Now, this is not where they take a little piece of bone and make an ape man out of them, like the evolutionists are so fond of doing, but where they use proven police forensics and anthropological science to determine, you know, the skin and the tone of the muscles and everything in the face to try to identify a Jane Doe. Now, we have just the skeleton. We're trying to, you know, get a picture of what this person looked like so they might be identified. They did this with a Neanderthal child, and this was the result they got. It could be any of our children today. They were definitely humans, descended from Adam, made in the image of God. So a conclusion after nearly 150 years, looking all over the world trying to find evidence, we find they have nothing but apes. By their own admissions now. Basically, all they have to talk about of any weight today is the Australopithecines, and there are some of them, even in the National Academy of Sciences, saying they're nothing but apes. We've been barking up the wrong tree for decades. What about Homo erectus, Neanderthal? Many evolutionists admit Homo erectus and Neanderthal are so human. If they were alive today, they could intermarry with us and have fertile children, the primary accepted definition of the same species, if they speak with forked tongue. Because on other hands, they say, well, no, they were different species, but they admit they could intermarry if they were alive today and have human children. So you can't have it both ways, it appears. They were different ethnic varieties of descendants of Adam, just like you and I. As far as the Cro-Magnon people, they were essentially the same ethnic type as modern Europeans. So they were certainly human. So we have either apes or we have men. And that elusive ape man simply has not been found by anything approaching credible, convincing evidence, even though nearly 150 years of time, effort, and billions of dollars expenditure has been given trying to prove this thing. You know, that makes sense. There's no evidence at the bottom of the tree of evolution. It's mathematically, chemically, physically, thermodynamically impossible. We have huge gaps there that show it could not happen, it did not happen. Why should we expect to find evidence at the top of the tree when there's absolutely no evidence at the bottom? What we see here shows that the most accurate, the most up-to-date, the most reasonable, the most believable statement on human origins is still found in a book thousands of years old, a book authored by the Spirit of God, a book that says man and woman were made in the image of the Creator, that we have our ascendancy and our gifts and our powers and our dominance in this world, not by the whims of chance and nature, but it was ordained by God and made us in our image. That is the most credible statement ever written. Human origins. In conclusion, I quote Lord Sally Zuckerman, again, this renowned evolutionist anthropologist. He says, for example, no scientist could logically dispute the proposition that man, without having been involved in any act of divine creation, so it makes it clear he doesn't believe in creation, but he says, man must have evolved from some ape-like creature in a very short space of time, speaking in geological terms, without leaving any fossil traces of the steps of the transformation. So with his expert in paleoanthropology, he says, we have apes and we have men, and nothing in between is worth the paper it's written on. And he's an atheist evolutionist. He's only saying that because it's true. So he has to defend that by faith. Now, the biblical definition of faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. But for evolutionists like Lord Zuckerman, their definition of faith has to go like this. Now, faith is the substance of fossils hoped for, the evidence of links not seen. So although it may be true that some of your ancestors and mine actually did hang by the neck in the past, I don't believe any of them ever hung by the tail. And indeed, there's nothing approaching convincing, credible evidence that that story is true. The good news is that we're not compelled by overwhelming evidence to believe the philosophy of hopelessness and despair, of meaninglessness and worthlessness. The evidence shows the Bible is credible, that its understanding, its declaration of our origin makes more sense than any other theory that's ever been proposed. And that's good news. We have meaning, we have purpose, we have destiny, we're made in the image of the Creator, we are destined to be princes and princesses in His royal family, as the children of the Father and the bride of Jesus Christ. I'd rather believe that any day, and the good news is evidence supports it too.